welcome to Comic Talk Today for Monday, July 13th, 2018. And this is the episode of the week in which I talk about last week's comics, and I like to call it the top of the pile. I hope everyone had a great weekend. I know I did. It was a little busy, but I'm on vacation this week, so there will be an episode pretty much every day this week. We'll see. In typical top of the pile tradition, I'll be discussing some of my favorite books, including one that maybe wasn't so much my favorite, but I want to talk about it. This week I'll be talking about two Marvel books, two Image books, two DC books, and one Aftershock book. So let's go in that order and kick things off talking about Marvel. And first up on the Marvel docket is The Amazing Spider-Man number 3, written by Nick Spencer with art by Ryan Ottley, inks by Cliff Rathburn, colors by Laura Martin, and letters by Joe Caramagna. Now, I didn't talk about issue number 2 when it came out. I did talk about the first one because I was excited to read this, and I wasn't that high on the book. And I'm still really not very high on the book, so let me just go ahead and say that outright. This is not my favorite Spider-Man book. However, I will say this. This third issue was really, really interesting because Nick Spencer is doing something that I've never seen anyone do with a Spider-Man comic. And that is, he has separated Peter Parker and Spider-Man into two different entities. And at first it was a little confusing, right? I think maybe the way that the story is structured, it's meant to be a little confusing and leave you asking some questions. But as you get into the later on in the story, and Peter goes and talks to Doc Connor, we learn kind of really what it is that's going on. So at first I thought, well, why is there a Peter Parker and a Spider-Man? Because there's a couple of pages in which the two characters interact. And they're trying to figure out, like, are you me or are you not me? Are you somebody else? And that's kind of the question that I had. I was like, well, are we kind of going, like, Clone Saga direction again? And it seems like that's not the case at all. So the machine that kind of created the Spider-Man persona, which bonded Peter Parker and the Spider, is still being tested by Doc Connor. And it seems like during one of his adventures in which Spider-Man fought the Taskmaster, he got hit by the machine again, and somehow it separated Peter and Spider-Man into two different entities. And this issue kind of deals with kind of the repercussions of that, what it means to do that. And I thought that was so interesting because while the premise of the story is really quite outrageous, I think it works really well for this character because what we're trying to do is, I mean, the name of the story arc is Back to Basics, right? And that's what Nick Spencer is trying to do. He's trying to get Spider-Man back to basics because for the last few years with Dan Slott, there have been some kind of weird things going on, right? Like Peter Parker becoming sort of like the new Tony Stark, right? He had his company, Parker Industries, I guess it was called, which he was pretty much serving as Tony Stark for the Marvel Universe. He was creating technology, and it was a little out there. We're trying to get away from that, right? So Peter's been de-aged a little bit, it seems like, but maybe not. That's still a little confusing to me. And so what we're trying to do is figure out what makes Peter Parker Peter Parker and what makes Spider-Man Spider-Man. And we learned through the conversation with Doc Connor, who's been experimenting on this rat named Horatio, what this ray gun can do. And so we see this little rat that's been trained to run a maze, and after he gets hit with the ray, it splits into two different rats. So we have Horatio 1, Horatio 2, and Horatio 1 can no longer run through the maze, but he's got other skills. Whereas Horatio 2 is an expert at the maze, but doesn't care to do other rat things. And of course, Peter is thinking in his head the whole time, like, okay, this makes sense, because this is kind of the thing that I'm experiencing. Meantime, Spider-Man is fighting the Tri-Sentinel in the streets of New York City, which I thought that was pretty cool. Tri-Sentinel's an interesting character. And we're seeing this whole thing happen through the TV as Doc Connor is explaining to Peter what the machine does. I think this is really interesting. I was planning on dropping this book after the next issue, but I'm kind of glad that I stuck with it because I think separating the two characters into two different entities could make for some really interesting storylines. I hope we don't get into some super deep convoluted thing, kind of like we did with the Clone Saga. I hope this is a little bit more of a straightforward story, and I'm sure it's not going to last for very long. Now, whether this separate entity that's Spider-Man, who is also Peter Parker, so I'm sure there'll be some interesting things going on there now that Peter and Mary Jane are kind of back together. I hope that doesn't end up being another clone type or become a villain of some sort. I want to see this whole thing explored as to what it means to be Peter, what it means to be Spider-Man, and eventually the two get back into one body. I think that could be really interesting. So we'll see. I'm Like I said, I thought about dropping this, but I think after this issue, I'm going to stick with it just to see how the story ends up going. And I hope it doesn't take forever either, because I don't want my initial excitement for this issue to really be dragged out for, I don't know, 12, 20 issues. Unless the story is really good. And right now, I'm not completely sold on the story. I have some gleams of hope for what this book can become. So we'll see how that ends up going. But I really enjoyed the issue. And I got to say, Ryan Otley's art is freaking amazing in this book. So really enjoying that. I had some issues with the humor. And I know people that really love the Spider-Man books like it partially because of the humor. And the humor is to be expected. And Nick Spencer is very good at providing humor. But there were a couple jokes in here that didn't quite work for me. Like there was some Curb Your Enthusiasm jokes, which I was kind of like, okay, it's a little bit on the nose, but you know, whatever. I'll deal with it. There were some jokes involving Dan Slott's run previously, which I thought were pretty funny. So overall, pretty solid story. Again, not completely sold on this new Spider-Man book, but I am now again willing to give this a couple more issues to see where the story goes. Overall, if I had to rate it, I'm going to give it a 3.5 out of 5. I think it's a solid book. Maybe not for me yet, but we'll see. And I'm definitely enjoying the journey as I move forward, simply based on this issue. Of course, I have to talk about Fantastic Four number 1, the return of the Fantastic Four. This is written by Dan Slott, and then we have a couple different artists because there's 3 different stories in this first issue. The main story, Signal in the Sky, is illustrated by Sarah Pacelli. We have Our Day of Doom and Victory, which is a Dr. Doom-centric story in Latveria. That's written by Simone Bianchi. And then What the Pop at the End is illustrated by Scotty Young. Now, in terms of the story itself, I think this was a nice setup issue. I expected quite a bit of backlash, actually, based on what I knew about this book going into it. And I'm surprised how much people love it. And I'm happy that that's the case. I do wonder if some of that initial excitement has to do with the fact that the Fantastic Four have been gone for several years now. Even though, you know, we've seen Johnny Storm in Inhumans, Ben Grimm was fighting with the Guardians. Of course, the two were hanging out together in Marvel 2-in-1 by Chip Zdarsky, which was fantastic. Brilliant book. And, you know, if you enjoy the Marvel 2-in-1, which I don't know how many people were reading it, but those of us that did really dug it, this first story kind of follows in the vein of that 2-in-1 story, which I liked. It was nice that they managed to continue the story based on the events of the 2-in-1 stuff. Really, really dug that stuff. Of course, Reed and Sue are not here yet, and that's part of the reason why I was concerned that people would be outraged, because we don't actually see the team together, right? Reed and Sue are still kind of stuck in this alternate dimension. And this issue deals a lot with kind of the fallout of Ben and Johnny kind of dealing with Reed and Sue not being around. And I thought that was very well done. Really well done. You know, Johnny is very optimistic about them coming back. And Ben, not so much, right? Ben's kind of gotten used to the fact that they're gone and that they're never going to be coming back. But Johnny's kind of still looking forward to it. In fact, there's a gang of kids up on a rooftop. They robbed this place and they stole the original Fantastic Four flare signal. And, they shot it up on the rooftop. And Johnny's like, oh my God, the Fantastic Four signal. He's like, you know, Reed and Sue are back. And he transforms and goes over to see what's going on. And of course, he's disappointed that it's not actually the team getting back together. He goes back to Ben and Ben's like, look, I told you. And he's like, yeah, I should just admit that, you know, Reed and Sue are gone. And just as that is happening, Reed and Sue find a way to signal the four signal from space. And everyone's like, holy moly, like Reed and Sue are still out there. We need to figure out how to get them back. And that's kind of where this part of the story ends. I thought it was quite well done. There's a lot of character development, in particular with Johnny and Ben. And again, we've been seeing a lot of them over the last couple of years, but it's nice to see that that's the direction that was chosen to begin this new story, this new chapter in the Fantastic Four. And, you know, we'll see how that ends up going. I'm very curious to know how they're going to bring Reed and Sue back, but it's really nice to see this book come together in such a way. I mean, the art is fantastic. It's very well paced, great character development. I really enjoy this story quite a bit. The Dr. Doom story that takes place, kind of as a backup was pretty interesting. I'm not sure I dig the Dr. Doom costume. My assumption is that they're going to be changing it once he actually fully returns to the book. But, you know, after everything that's happened to Doom over the last couple of years, he's kind of back in his hometown, and he gets awakened by this rebellious woman who is trying to inform him, hey, like, we need Doom back because we're kind of stuck in this system where the government doesn't care about any of us, and we need you back, which I thought was really interesting because, I mean, he is kind of a dictator in some way, right? And he's like, yeah, he's like, I need to fight for my people. And that's one thing that I got to give him. He is all about his country and his people, whether the way he rules his country and his people, I completely agree with, is a different story, but he does definitely seem to care quite a bit for him. And so he does, he goes out and starts fighting with the rebellion and takes down some of these opposing forces and, definitely, very violently in some cases. And we finally get to see Doom back, but he's got no shirt. He's got these giant nipples. I don't know. It was a little weird, but the art was nice. And, I like to see the scarred up Doom. We don't like really see his face, but you can kind of tell from the shadows. And, I thought that was really well done as well. Overall, I really enjoyed Fantastic Four number one. It was not my favorite book of the week, and it was not as good as I had expected it to be, but, definitely a worthwhile book to check out. And, a really nice return to form for these characters. Based on what I saw in this issue, I think going forward, in particular with issue two, in 3, I would assume, when Reed and Sue actually come back to Earth, I think, this will be a nice story, to read every single month. And I think eventually we'll get back to getting the Fantastic Four to basics. You know, when the whole team is back together, you know, we don't need to kick things off with just like Galactus showing up or some Skrull invasion popping up or whatever. I like that. You know, we're taking it slowly. We're developing these characters because I'm sure there are definitely readers who may not have read Fantastic Four, or because the book's been gone so long that, you know, people may have forgotten who some of these people are. Really nicely done. If I had to rate this one, I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5. I can't give it a 4 out of 4. It's not a rating. 4 out of 5. It's quite good. And the art is brilliant, by the way. Very briefly, I want to mention Howard Chaykin's Hey Kids Comics number 1 from Image Comics with a horrendous cover that I hated because it's a photo cover and photo covers are terrible 99.9% of the time. But it does kind of tell you what this book is about because in the cover you see this YC powerhouse, which is sort of like a Superman analog that does play a part in the story. And, you know, I mentioned this book a little bit in Top of the Pile last week, or not on Top of the Pile, in the Comic Predictor, and how I was looking forward to it. Because I do like this kind of story. And this reads very much like I compared it to Marvel The Untold Story, which is kind of a behind-the-scenes look at how Marvel Comics developed over the years, right, from the 60s until today, and kind of the struggles of running that company, the clash of personalities between different people. And Hey Kids Comics is basically that kind of thing. It's an inside look at the behind the scenes of how comics work on a day-to-day basis, in particular back in those days, and told in this kind of fictionalized story with you know, all the names have been changed, the way people look have been changed, some people have been kind of amalgamated into one. But it works really well. There's definitely some Stan Lee in here. There's a character that's very much like Stan Lee from what I know of Stan. There's one that's very Kirby as well. And the book can be a little difficult to read. It does take place over the decades. So there's a story in like 1945 when some of these comic creators who worked in comics before World War II come back from the war and decide to get back into comics. There's a section in 1955 which kind of deals with how things have gone over the years since the war. There's a flash forward to 1967, and then I think we fast forward all the way to 2011, and that was kind of the interesting stuff as well, because of course by then everyone's a lot older, and there's a lot of history between all these characters, and there's probably about, I don't know, about 6 to 8 central characters that we follow in this book, so that can be a little bit difficult as well. And and it was cool because there was even like a quote-unquote X-Men reference. I can't remember what they were called, but you definitely can tell from the poster. It was like, I don't know, Power Teens or something like that. And the poster had like a DNA strand going through it. So definitely like an X-Men analog. But really well done overall. It's pretty obvious to me right now that Howard Chaykin's just kind of doing whatever the hell he wants. And Image is letting him have the space to tell whatever story he wants. And I think that's important. I think it's important. I know some people kind of don't like what he's done with this previous book. I'm sure many people will not enjoy this book either. And I gotta tell you, if you're just a fan of Capes and Cowls, you're gonna hate this book. If you like indie stuff, like, like Terry Moore stuff, you might be a little more into this. This is very, very much more nonfiction than anything else. Even though it's a fictional story, it's definitely more nonfiction. It kind of reads like, oh man, what's it called? The Fade Out. The Ed Brubaker story about the 1940s Hollywood. It almost reads like that. And if you enjoy that kind of thing, then this might be a book for you. Art is great. It's typical Chaykin art. And I think the story flows pretty well. Again, a little bit difficult to read, but very enjoyable overall. I'm going to give this one also a 4 out of 5. While still on the Image front, let's talk about The Dead Hand number 5. This is written by Kyle Higgins with art by Stephen Mooney, colors by Jordi Belair, and letters by Clayton Cowles. And I really love this book. If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you will know that I've talked about this at least 3 times. 3 different issues, of course. But I really enjoy this book. If you like Cold War espionage type stuff, then this is a book that you should be reading. It is fantastic. It is so well executed from every level. The writing's fantastic. The dialogue's great. The art is fantastic. Everything's great about this book. And of course, throughout the series, we've gotten little hints of kind of what's going on, but we really don't understand why these people have settled on this town in the middle of Siberia and what this little robot kid is in the background. And in this issue, we learn the whole story, basically. I mean, we kind of knew from the last issue, and I think even before that, that Roger was not actually a child, that he's a computer who, when he talks to people, sees himself as a child talking to them. When people look at him, all they see is the computer screen because he doesn't actually speak that we know of. He might speak, but it's not really said in the word balloons. Really what we see is his dialogue show up on a screen above the monitors. And in this issue, we find out exactly what happened. So during the final days of the Cold War, Russia had decided to find a backup for mutually assured self-destruction. Okay, so basically, if the U.S. launched a nuclear attack on Russia, that there would be a way to launch a retaliatory attack back on the U.S. with Russia's own nuclear missiles. And so they had to devise a way to do that. And so originally, they came up with this way where the computer would kind of oversee things. And if it saw that radiation levels went up and whatever else, it would send a signal to somebody in a bunker and would give them control over the nuclear launch codes instead of, you know, having the president do it. And at first they thought that was fine, but then they realized, well, what if it's just the entire country is radioactive and everybody's dead? Then nobody can launch nukes in retaliation. So they decided to create this sort of artificial intelligence. They don't quite call it that. I think they call it like an autonomous system, something like that. But basically an AI, and that's what Roger is. And the AI's ultimate goal is to protect Russia against, you know, all invaders. And once our main character, cast of characters, figured all this out, and the president of Russia at the time said, hey, like, now that the Cold War's over, we have a problem because we created this AI that if it senses any danger to Russia, it will launch nuclear missiles in retaliation. And so all the governments of the world kind of united and found out a solution to this. And the solution was to send some of these spies to live in this city in Siberia where the AI was. And so that's why we have this city. And over time, you know, there's people like kids have grown up in this town. They don't know the secret of it, just the adults do. And that's kind of our way into learning about the story, because one of the kids found the bunker where Roger is, and they decided to tell her what's going on so that Roger wouldn't feel threatened. Because Roger definitely would feel threatened by having an outsider learn about who he is, right? He's very testy, and we've seen him get very angry in previous issues when stuff doesn't quite go the way that it should. And so basically, this is like a multinational effort to keep this AI happy so the AI does not launch nuclear missiles around the world. Really cool story. And I love that was the way that it was explained. Obviously, if you've been reading this book, you probably figured all that while you were reading the book, just based on the little tidbits that we've seen throughout the book. But there was some nice callbacks to the first issue in issue 5 as well, which I really enjoyed. But this book is really brilliant. I'm surprised not more people are reading it, but Dead Hand is just one of the books that you need to be checking out. I'm going to give this one a 5 out of 5. Matter of fact, I think I've given every issue that I've talked about a 5 out of 5. So there's that. That should tell you something. Go check it out. Let's move over to DC and talk about Red Hood and the Outlaws number 25. All right, just very briefly, because I've already done this, and I've talked about it on Twitter at length. I had Bill on last week. Bill and I talked about it a little bit. You need to be reading Red Hood and the Outlaws. Matter of fact, I think Ronnie and I talked about it on Saturday's episode as well. Go pick up this book. I guarantee you, if you read issues 24 and 25, you will want to go back and pick up the series from the first issue. And I gotta say, not a lot of people talk about this book. I guess maybe because it's not just like a Batman book or Superman book or Justice League book. There's not like huge universe-changing things going on here. But let me tell you, there is some really interesting stuff going on in this book. In particular with issue 25, where we now have the Red Hood going up against Batman. Because at the end of issue 24, the Red Hood killed, we assume, shot Penguin in the head and killed him, live on TV. And of course, Batman can't have that, because part of the reason he allowed Red Hood to operate in Gotham City was that he would not kill, and now he broke that rule. So he's basically getting thrown out of the Bat family, and that's kind of going to be important with issue 26 as the book launches in a new direction where Red Hood gets a new costume, he's got new teammates, we see Arsenal pop back into this issue, so I'm sure he'll be part of the next arc, but really fantastic. Written by Scott Lobdell, the art is Dexter Soy, Trevor Hairston, Ryan Wynn, Phil Hester, and Andy Parks. Colors is Veronica Gardini, Ryan Barreto, and Mad Pencil Studio, and letters by Taylor Esposito. And let me tell you, that's a whole lot of people to work on one issue, but you can barely tell. I mean, Dexter Soy and Trevor Hairston and Phil Hester do have distinct art styles. But I think editorial did a really good job at finding a way to have these styles make sense together. And it really worked. It was not jarring at all. And I think oftentimes that's a problem with some of these books. When there are multiple artists, this was not the case here. Absolutely brilliant issue. This issue is a game changer. Absolutely loved it. Red Hood is one of my top DC books every single month, and I never talk about it, so I wanted to talk about it. This book is also a 5 out of 5. Go check it out. And the final DC book is going to be the Sandman Universe number 1. We have a story by Neil Gaiman. Not written, story by, written by Simon Spurrier, Cat Howard, Nalo Hopkinson, and Dan Waters, which of course are the writers for the new books that are coming out. We've got The Dreaming coming out in September, September 5th, House of Whispers, September 12th, Lucifer, October 17th, and Books of Magic on the 24th of October. Art is Bilquis Evely, brilliant stuff, by the way. Tom Fowler, also brilliant. Dominique Stanton, Max Fumara, and Sebastian Fumara. And this was a great reintroduction to the Sandman universe. So I got to give props to DC for doing this. I think it works very well because some of these characters have been gone for quite a while. And yes, this is not Neil Gaiman, but I think overall it was really, really brilliantly achieved. I think having Gaiman do the oversight on the direction of these books will really pay off in the end. And of course, we've seen a lot of these characters, right? So like The Dreaming, we've had a Books of Magic book before, we had Lucifer before. The brand new thing is House of Whispers, which I'm really curious about because it's set in New Orleans, which means that there's going to be a lot of voodoo magic in here. And that's something that really hasn't been explored in this the Sandman universe previously. And definitely looking forward to seeing how that works out. The story in here was interesting, but I don't think there was enough meat in it for me to know what is happening. So I want to learn more, and I'm definitely going to be picking that one up. It might be the one that I'm most excited about, is House of Whispers. But I thought the other ones were really, really quite well done. Lucifer seemed like much more of a horror book than I remember it being, which is nice. Really enjoyed the Dreaming story quite a lot, actually. I think the Dreaming story in this Sandman universe may have been one of my favorites because the Dreaming are so, I don't know, they're so odd, right? The way they speak, the way they act, the way they react to things. And, you know, it seems like they're looking for Dream of the Endless. And, you know, we've seen Dream in DC Metal, so I'm sure there's going to be some kind of connection to the DC universe proper. This is technically a Vertigo book, but depending on how, like what you look at, sometimes it's placed in under the DC banner, sometimes it's placed under the Vertigo banner, so I'm not sure if even DC knows what's happening here. If you know, if this has been formally announced somewhere, then let me know. But I was looking at the Indica, and even in Indica it just says DC for the most part, except for a copyright notice for DC Vertigo. So I don't know. Let me know if you know, because I'm curious. But this was nicely done. There's 4 different stories, so each one tackles one of the 4 books that are going to be coming out. And it really sets up what's going to happen in those books. So it's kind of like a zero issue in some ways for each of those books, but quite well done. And there's no breaks in between stories, which was really nicely done. And the way that that's done is through the Raven that shows up in the dreaming story at the beginning. He kind of follows all of these characters throughout the different stories and kind of helps to narrate what's happening to the reader. But I really enjoy this one quite a bit. I'm looking forward to the relaunch of the Sandman universe. I'm surprised it's not a Sandman book, but I guess maybe I'm not surprised. I'm sure they'll just be doing the Sandman story as part of the Dreaming, and maybe that'll be the connecting thread between all these books. Overall, really dug it. There was a couple things missing for me in some of these stories. Again, I wanted more out of House of Whispers. I wanted the Lucifer story to be a little bit longer. It was really probably the shortest one of the bunch, and but we'll see. We'll see. I think for a zero type issue, a prologue issue, it definitely did its job, and it's got me excited for what's coming up next. So I'm going to give this one a 4 out of 5. The last book I want to talk about is Hot Lunch Special number 1 from Aftershock Comics. And of course, I talked about this at length with my buddy Travis on the Aftershock Central podcast. You can catch my thoughts fully in that particular episode. This is written by Elliot Rahal, who does brilliant work. Art by Jorge Fornes, who I'm not familiar with, but I really love the art in this issue. Letters by Taylor Esposito. Man, Taylor sure gets around. And really nicely done. This is a fictionalized autobiography, I would say, of Elliot Rahal. It seems like some of the characters in the story are definitely based on his family. I know he was tweeting about he visited some comic shop, and it was near the place that his grandfather owned, that was like a casino, and that shows up in the story. So while a lot of things may have been changed and maybe some things kind of embellished a little bit for the sake of the story, it seems like there's definitely some true things in this book that actually happened in Elliot's family's life, which I find interesting because a lot of times, you know, autobiographical stories aren't really, I mean, there's cool stuff, but it can be a little boring. This is very much a crime story, and to have somebody who has kind of had that in their family, it's just, I don't know, that's kind of cool. Maybe not cool if you lived in it, but reading the story is. So basically what this is about, it's a Lebanese family who starts a sandwich company, and they deliver sandwiches to vending machines all around Minnesota. And part of the story takes place in Minnesota, some of it in the Dakotas. And it really goes back all the way to the main family's like great grandparents. So it's like told over 3 generations, most of it through flashbacks. But when the story kicks off, there's like a finger found in a sandwich. And that way we learn a little bit about some of the backstory, some of the characters based on the investigation that the police are doing. Through flashbacks, we learn about the main character's grandfather who fought in the war. And when he came back, he started this company, and how there was some mob relations. And those mob relations kind of develop over the decades to get to the point where we are in the present, in which it seems like the mob is out to kill some of the family members. And the reason for that is there's a deal that's made for distribution that isn't kind of followed, and this mob family isn't really happy with the new distribution, and so they want to get more money out of it. And part of the way that they kind of coerce this Lebanese family to do it is to start killing family members. And really interesting, really well done. And nobody here is a nice character, by the way. Everyone's kind of douchey and out for themselves. And I kind of like that. It makes for a very interesting read. The art is absolutely fantastic. Every single page of it. And, you know, when we have the flashback scenes, it's told more in like a sepia colored tones. The current present day stuff is in black and white, but, well done. Really well done. If I had to rate this one, I mean, I'm going to give it a 5 out of 5 because that's what I rated it before. But I think this is a book that was really unexpected for me. When I heard there was a book coming out called Hot Lunch Special, I said to myself, why in the world would I read that? That is the worst name ever. But having read the book, it's totally irrelevant. And I hope that if you haven't picked this up, you can get past the name and check the book out, because it is a fantastic story. If you've watched Fargo, the TV show, it's basically like reading a comic book version of Fargo. Totally, totally well done. Yeah, same kind of pacing, just brilliant, brilliant character development. Engrossing story, fun characters. Definitely look forward to checking this one out. Go pick it up if you haven't. All right, that's the top of the pile. I think now it is time to look forward in time and do a little segment I like to call the Comic Predictor. and which I'll give you some recommendations for this week's New Comic Book Day. And I've got quite a few. Some new stuff, some old stuff, some returning stuff. First up on the list is Volition number 1 from Aftershock Comics. This is written by Ryan Parrott with art by Omar Francia. And this is a not too distant future story in which humanity has created sort of artificial intelligence. There's robots running around, and they're created to kind of serve humanity, and they're kind of second class citizens. And the robots kind of achieve self-consciousness, I guess you could say, and they start fighting for their rights, for equal rights. And having checked out the preview pages last week, I haven't read the book yet. I think it's in my inbox somewhere. But having looked at the art, I mean, it is a beautiful looking book. And I love this kind of story. I love Philip K. Dick stuff, right? And every time I see a story that's kind of in this vein, it reminds me of Philip K. Dick stuff. So I'm always all in on it. But really looking forward to it. Like I said, the art looks brilliant. The premise is very interesting. And we'll see how it ends up going. But I will be recommending Volition number 1. A little odd pick that I want to give is Terminator Sector War number 1. And the reason I'm picking this is that it's written by Brian Wood. And of course, I've talked about Brian Wood because I'm loving Sword Daughter over at Dark Horse. He is doing a Terminator book, and this one seems a little different than other Terminator books. So it's written by Brian Wood, art by Jeff Stokely and Robert Samlin. And this tells a kind of parallel story to the original Terminator story. So in 1984, there were two Terminators sent back. One was sent back to kill Sarah Connor before she gave birth. And the other one was sent to target this NYPD officer, Lucy Castro. And I don't know anything about Lucy Castro, but I want to know why the Terminator's after her. So she's kind of stuck in this downbeaten part of the city, being chased by one of the T-800s. And hopefully we learn why. And hopefully this makes sense in the overall arc of Terminator. Because I love that franchise. And I love that they're trying something new here. So Terminator Sector War number 1, that's from Dark Horse. Definitely give that one a shot. Batman 53, of course, I have to talk about because this is the continuation of this Cold Days arc that we're seeing in which Bruce Wayne is part of the trial for Mr. Freeze. I can't talk enough about this current arc. As down as I've been on Batman since Rebirth started, I've really enjoyed everything from issue 50 on, and I think 51, 52 have gotten progressively better and better, and I can only assume that 53 will continue that. I'm really loving Batman right now, and it's really nice to hear me say that, so I will be checking this out. Of course, I probably don't need to recommend Batman to anyone because it's one of the top-selling books every month, but definitely looking forward to this one. If you've been kind of out of Batman for a little while, go and pick up 51, 52, and then 53 this week when it comes out. Over at DC Comics, I'm recommending Pearl number 1. This is a 6-issue miniseries written by Brian Michael Bendis with art by Michael Gatos. And yes, it is the team that created Jessica Jones. And this is part of the Jinx World imprint that Bendis is doing. How this man is going to write so many books, I don't know. Because, you know, he's doing the 2 Superman books. He's doing Pearl. There was another one that was advertised. I mean, he's going to be doing like 6 books here in a couple of months. And I don't know how he finds time for it. But Pearl number 1, brand new character for this relaunch of Jinx World. And it's a woman who is a fantastic tattoo artist. She's also an assassin for the Yakuza in San Francisco. It seems like there may be some kind of supernatural stuff going on. I'm assuming based on the description of it. It's not really stated, but I see something going on with the tattoos. Maybe that plays a part in why she's such a great assassin. And it's going to follow her life as she kind of realizes that maybe she doesn't want to be part of the Yakuza anymore and how she can try to get away from that. The art, I mean, Michael Gatiss is just brilliant. And this cover looks absolutely fantastic. So I cannot wait to get my hands on this book. Pearl number 1 from DC Comics. Over at Image, we've got Crowded number 1. This is written by Chris Sabella with art by Rose Stein. And I got to tell you, Chris Sabella is a really interesting dude. Because I don't think this man has ever done 2 books that deal with the same topic. I'm reading, what's it called, Shanghai Red right now. That's an Image book. And it's about, it's set like in the 1800s. People that get shanghaied, you know, they get kidnapped to kind of serve on a ship, on a merchant ship. And it's very dark and violent and gritty. He just finished doing Cold War over Aftershock. And that was kind of a futuristic, super violent, time travel-y / I don't even know, post-apocalyptic story. Crowded is set in the near future, and it basically is an extrapolation of our current society in which everything is crowdfunded, and there's a crowdfunding app called Reaper in which people crowdfund assassination attempts. And this one girl is targeted in a $1 million Reaper campaign, and so we have to follow her as she tries to get away from basically the entire city of Los Angeles trying to kill her. I don't know. I'm looking forward to this. The art looks pretty cool. It's a little more cartoony, but I think it'll work for this kind of story, and I can't wait to read it. I really like Chris DiBella's stuff. Over at Marvel, we've got Edge of Spider-Geddon number 1. This is a 4-issue miniseries, and I think these will be all one-shots in preparation for Spider-Geddon before that launches. This first issue will deal with Spider-Punk, and it's written by Jed McKay with art by Gerardo Sandoval, who worked on Venom. And, you know, I love Spider-Verse. Spider-Verse is one of my favorite all-time Spider-Man event stories. Really loved it. I'm glad that they're doing a follow-up to that in Spider-Geddon. And while Spider-Punk was not my favorite character of that series, I look forward to getting back to this world, so I'm going to recommend it. Edge of Spider-Geddon number 1 from Marvel Comics. And finally on the list, also from Marvel, we've got Extermination number 1 of 5. This is written by Ed Brisson with art by Pepe Larraz and Mark Brooks. And this is the brand new X-Men event. We haven't had an X-Men event in a while, so why not? And this will be centered mainly on the X-Men Blue characters, which are the original X-Men characters, and kind of, they're being targeted for death, and we'll see how whatever happens here will affect the future of the X-Men franchise. Of course, you know, we've got Uncanny X-Men is going to be relaunching soon. I'll be talking about that tomorrow when I do the news. But Uncanny's relaunching, there's going to be some shakeup in the X-Men world, and I think this could be a really interesting story if it's done well. And, you know, so far, I'm happy to say, Marvel has not disappointed me with the majority of the books that I'm reading. So, definitely will be picking up Extermination number 1. Last but not least, from Action Lab Danger Zone, I'm going to recommend 12 Devils Dancing number 2. This is written by Erica Schultz, whom I talked to a couple of weeks ago. The first issue was brilliant. Now you're thinking to yourself, it's 2 issues, I don't want to read it. Look, the first issue was basically issues 1 through 3. Issue 2 is like issues 4 through 6. It's a 6-issue story that was condensed into 2 issues. It's $2.99 for 65 pages. Why are you not picking this up? Plus, the subject matter is awesome. It's about an FBI agent who's retired after catching this serial killer. And it turns out that maybe he didn't catch a serial killer. They got the wrong guy. And maybe the right guy is somebody that he grew up with. So there's this like cult thing, there's serial killer stuff. This book is fantastic. Fantastic. I love a lot of things that Action Lab is doing, and this might be at the top of my list. So I'm going to put this on the recommendation engine. 12 Devils Dancing number 2. Go pick this up. You will not be disappointed. Art by David Costa, by the way. Brilliant stuff. All right, that's going to be the end of the episode. Thank you all for listening. We have a brand new week. I hope you're all excited. I know it's Monday. You're probably dragging. You're like, ugh. Don't give me that excitement stuff. It's Monday. We have 5 more days of work. Well, you know, I'm on vacation, like I said, so I'm a little excited. And you should be too. We've got a full week planned for the podcast. There'll be an episode almost every day this week. And some interesting announcements that I'll be doing. I'll be talking about probably towards the end of the week. And I think this will be it. If you want to get in touch with me, at Geekvine is the best place. That's on Twitter, because I love Twitter, even though it can be a cesspool sometimes. I love Twitter. Email is nerdylegion@gmail.com, so you can email me there. You can email suggestions, tell me how much the podcast sucks, how much you hate it. And while you do that, you can go on iTunes or whatever other place you listen to the podcast and review the show. I don't care if you tell me I'm terrible, but I want you to give the show 5 stars so other people can tell me I'm terrible. Thank you all for listening. I will be back tomorrow with the news.